Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's a pleasure to have as my guest Irving Feldman, who's collected poems from 1954 to 2004, has been published by Schocken. Now, what happened is that I was at a party, met someone who told me that Irving Feldman comes to Los Angeles with some regularity. I said, oh, how wonderful, I'd love to have him on my show. The very next week, I heard that Irving Feldman would be here. So I had a book of collected poems. This is 50 years of poetry. And I read the whole book, but I don't think in my whole life I've sat down to read someone's complete work overnight, unless it were, you know, years ago in the classroom, you know, and even then we read selections. So I'm full of Irving Feldman right now, and it is a remarkable body of work. So many different kinds of poems, so many tones and voices, ranging from, well, I'm actually going to use what Cynthia Ozick said, a choir of multiplicity, ranging from the cosmically Miltonic to the up-to-the-minute vernacular. He is psalmist and satirist, elegist and stand-up comic, mandarin and graffiti artist, philosopher and town crier, romantic and skeptic. Well, it's true, he is. And, you know, if you get used to a poet who can reliably offer a characteristic tone, you can come to know what they're doing fairly quickly. Whereas, you know, reading Irving Feldman, I found I had read 200 pages of the collected poems and still was being surprised by the tonalities, by the positions taken, and also very appreciative of the fact that the poetry seemed to belong to no camp. It seemed to be, he's his own poet. I thought perhaps a way to begin would be with a poem from one of the early books, a poem called As Fast as You Can, and maybe you'd like to introduce it.
The poem, As Fast as You Can, of course, invokes the little refrain from the story of the gingerbread man. Run, run as fast as you can, you can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man. And I should say about it, what one of the things that the typography will make clear to a reader that may not be apparent to an auditor is that our subtlest appetite, I designate at the end, is our appetite for freedom. And what the poem does is trace the birth of the gingerbread man, as the cookie he was, until his final demise as the little story has it in the jaws of the fox who tricks him into letting himself be eaten as fast as you can. Loosed from the shaping hand, who lay at the window, face to the open sky, the fever of birth now cooling, cooling. I, said the gingerbread man, leaping upright, laughing. The first faint dawn of breath roared in his lungs and toes. Down he jumped running. Sweet was the dream of speed that sped the ground under. Sweet the ease of this breathing which ran in his body as he now ran in the wind, leaf in the world's breathing. Sweeter still the risk he was running of boundaries first and then the unbounded, a murderous roadway that ended nowhere in trees, a cat at cream spill looking up, mysterious schoolboys grabbing. Certainly they saw him, a plump figure hurrying, garbed in 3 white buttons, edible boots, his head a hat in 2 dimensions. Powerfully then, his rhythmic running overtook the dream of his flight. He was only his breathing. He said, entering his body, "Like this, I can go on forever." Loping and leaping, the fox kept pace, hinted, fainting, over and under wherever, licking his chops and grinning to the hilt of his healthy gums. Breathing to his toes, the man ran faster, free in a world that was suddenly growing a bushy tail and a way of its own. No less his joy for the darkening race. Brilliant thought had dawned to his lips. He understood it, thrilling absolute of original breath, and said, "The world desires me. Somebody wants to eat me up." That stride transported flying him off earth and mystic into the fox's maw blazing. One with the world's danger, that now is nothingness and now a tooth, he transcended the matter of bread. His speed between the clickers was infinite. "Tell them this, that life is sweet," eagerly he told the happy fox, whose pink tongue assenting glibly assuaged the pure delirious crumbs. Others fable otherwise, of course. Having outsped our sight, he dazzles the spinning heavens, that fox our senses starved pretension. How else explain the world's ubiquitous odor of sweetness burning and the absence of ash? Shimmering and redolent, his spirit tempts our subtlest appetite. There he runs, freely on the wind. We sniff a sharp intelligence, lunge and snap our teeth at the breathable body of air, and murmur while it is flying by, "Life is unhappy, life is sweet."
Irving Feldman, reading As Fast as You Can. It was originally published as the first poem in his book, Lost Originals. Now, that book was published in the 70s, I think, and it sounds a certain, if I might say so, characteristic tone, opposition. The life is unhappy, life is sweet. A refusal that these poems, for the most part, make to come to an easy conclusion. And I wondered, there is often a figure running toward a receding future or being chased in your poems. He seems to be a person made of speed, in a sense. There's some kind of velocity. The nature of the running becomes the breath of the poem, and it seems like a more characteristic poem, if one can say you have a characteristic poem. And I wondered about what you might say about that.
Well, this poem in particular, and the volume to which it belongs, Lost Originals, as you note, was published in the early 70s. And I was engaged at that time in what amounted to me for a large revolution, perhaps in others a small one. Namely, I was reinventing for myself, as one has to do. That is the only thing one truly knows are things that are homemade. I was reinventing romanticism for myself, namely a sense of the sufficiency of the imagination. That is, that one need not expect imaginative things to lead to happy endings in the world. right? That is, you weren't gauging this sort of moral propensity. And so all of us here, Lost Originals, and As Fast As You Can, with its sort of recovery of childhood legend and the kind of adequacy that imagination has for a child, is very much in that vein, right? Aside from that, of course, is a kind of penchant I have for transcendence, for getting either above or below what is given. Right, and that, of course, is very much here in the speed that becomes infinite in the mortal circumstances of inhabiting the fox's teeth. At the same time, I'd begun playing squash about 4 years before this, and had rapidly become a squash addict, squash rackets, that is, and the sheer joy of breathing was very much a part of my daily experience.
Now, in the poem, at a certain point, the world itself is growing a bushy tail and a way of its own. So the world is becoming a fox.
The fox, yes.
And there's another poem called A Crone's Tale, I think.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Where the ocean becomes the sailors who
right.
are crawling up the island, who are going to eventually meet and be transformed themselves by the witch Circe.
Right, yeah.
But that sense of the world of creatures in the world becoming the world, or the world
mm-hmm.
becoming
yeah.
fox, the waves becoming seducing sailors, that's a very interesting and antagonistic involvement with a perception of the world around, that when it becomes enemy, it becomes itself enemy. You know, the world becomes fox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I do that, I think, perhaps in even a more devastating form in a poem called Ogres, which is the middle poem of three poems called Three Tales, which works out a kind of a cosmology. That is, I set myself the problem, the age-old problem, why is there something and not nothing? And the answer I supply is because we have been spared. And what I posit is that in these three poems is that there cannot be creation without destruction. There is no creation from nothing, and therefore there have been many universes in either destroyed by their creator or turning on the creator and in turn destroying him, right? And so in the middle of these poems, I have this creator as an ogre destroying his progeny, all the little worlds he has created like little children.
Irving Feldman, reading the middle section, Ogres, from Three Tales.
The land is his hunger the law. What he gets, he eats. I cannot endure. Blood in the streets, the very streams seem butchered, the sky a piece of meat. A friendly horror, the mouth emits a smile, the eyes just show their teeth. Takes them in hand, terrified, sick. Armies of tots flog toward his maw. The nimble, the quick, the tender, the sweet. Gibberish of shrieks, then drivel of limbs. I saw this, hidden in a heap of knuckles. The little hands were still reaching. I'm smeared with it. I feel nothing. Later on, I heard him explaining. I scratch these words with splintered bone. Because, after all, I'm your father. What else do you think I made you for? You owe me everything. Your food, your drink, your being. The ruddy flesh off your backs. This was no figure of speech. And then, ungrateful, where are you hiding? The shark, too, complains of his prey. why aren't they more forthcoming? Still later, he was at his bookkeeping, counting off on his fingers, muttering, 6 days to get Fetter Fatten. That's 6 days of fasting. On the 7th day, I eat. The monster, Moloch, fiend, leads each moppet up to the dish, and pointing all around, he whispers, this is the world. You will die. Sorry, Nipper. I caught him afterward asleep, still slobbering gore. Nothing fancy. I shoved his jaw down his throat, sent the head flying. This feeling of freedom, this joy. Strange, for all the absence of ogres, existence has proven no less fatal, and every death marked final. The sky is gone, just swallowed up. I think I'm dead, too. Look at him, his chines stripped, his jaws still clacking. I coolly fought to save my life, no longer rage to keep my innocence. I know who is my father's son. Look at how they look at me, push close with hunger or run in horror. Can't a man eat in peace anymore? My kids still think they'll live forever. I don't have immortality in my guts, only a clot of frozen terror. I'm hungry, too. I'll poke down deep in theirs. If there's any heaven in numbers, I'll find it. I'll eat it all. I'll teach them. I'll stop their staring.
Irving Feldman reading the second part of the poem, Three Tales. Now, in that book, the poem is followed by a poem called Family History.
Yes.
And it becomes, after one's heard a father talk about eating his children, a rather threatening proposition to hear about families. And in a sense, the family struggle has been a lifelong subject for you. And in this, again, I find it kind of astonishing to read a complete book, 400 pages of your work, and find the ongoing and never relinquishable subject of the family struggle. Even after their death, poems invoke the parents, the sisters, in very moving ways. And I wanted to see what you would say about the ongoingness of subjects for poetry.
Well, I generally try, so far as I can, to work against myself. Namely, if I've written a poem in one vein, one voice, etc., I will try it another. Often to do a poem of an entirely different kind. Often, you know, when work was going good, I would work at 4 or 5 poems, all different and all at the same time. So I work by consulting. I read a great deal what I've written in the past and looking for ways to either to make it better or to do it better or to find completely opposite ways of going about it.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Irving Feldman, author most recently of his collected poems, 1954 to 2004, published by Schocken. We'll continue after this short break.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Irving Feldman on the occasion of the publication of his collected poems, 1954 to 2004. If you look at these poems as a myriad of perspectives, there are terrifying fathers, and then there are sweeter, more gentle ones, and the sense of the world revolving among possibilities, the violent, the human, the timid, the brave, the arrogant. It's a fascinating sense of it, it feels like a worldview that somehow has a hierarchy of possibility, moving away from the brutal toward the human through different attributes, the sexual, the perceptive.
Right, yeah, as long as they're all allowed their place. No, I take my model from Tolstoy, who didn't represent as against, say, the biases of depth psychology, so-called. He didn't take there to be layers and depths and so on. Everything was present on the surface, so there has to be room in my world for all kinds of worlds. But I do have a poem, if there's time enough, called Our Father, which treats the father in another way, as a kind of child and stranger himself. Our Father, the stranger whose flesh we never ate, who rather sat at table with us eating, who for our sakes clothed himself in pelts like ours and went away far all times to everywhere until, clambering down starways into our street, he stood in the door, the dusk loaf under his arm, and unpacked the lamplight of the parlor corner where he called us to him and told us we were his. And lost in thought, led away our little army of mimics to parade the deep lanes of silence. Of our mother we ate always and plentifully. Her body was ours to possess, and we did so, thoughtlessly, yes, and also in adoration. But how shall we understand this stranger? And how are we ever to make amends to him, who had the power to eat us and didn't, who consented to abide in one house with us and hailed the sun down to make the dinner hour and bid bread to rise daily out of white dust, peopling it with mysterious vacancies, and new night after old washed the odd smells from himself with sleep and forgot his strangeness, and was one moment at dawn little again, hungry like us waiting to be fed. How then can we renew his acquaintance, that boy lost in the man, this man missing in the world, walking among all that must be inexplicable? And how are we to thank him properly, who salted our cheerful, selfish tongues with farewell and gave us his name to ponder, to pass on, to keep?
Irving Feldman, and that poem is called
Our Father.
Our Father. Now, still there, there's a kind of eat or be eaten sensibility. Is this tribal? What's the background to that worldview?
Well, the facts of the world. Namely, yes, fathers don't eat because they are chivalrous. Chivalrous, they learn to step aside to, in order for their children, particularly their sons, to flourish. And so, yes, it's there. It's there in the imaginations of the children.
I wanted to end with another poem that joins the parents with, well, it explains why the Messiah doesn't come, and our human business keeps us from welcoming the Messiah, and the mother has instructed us, has provided the model for the delay of the coming of the Messiah. This is a poem called Dream.
The Dream. Once, years after your death, I dreamt you were alive, and that I'd found you living once more in the old apartment. But I had taken a woman up there to make love to in the empty rooms. I was angry at you who'd born and loved me, and because of whom I believe in heaven. I regretted your return from the dead and said to myself almost bitterly, for God's sakes, what was the big rush? Couldn't she wait one more day? And just so, daily, somewhere, Messiah is shunned like a beggar at the door because someone has something he wants to finish, or just something better to do, something he prefers not to put off forever. Some little pleasure so deeply wished that heaven's coming has to seem bad luck or worse, God's intruding selfishness. But you always turn Messiah away with a penny and a cake for his trouble, because wash had to be done, because who could let dinner boil over and burn, because everything had to be festive for your husband, your daughters, your son.
I've been speaking with Irving Feldman, who's collected poems 1954 to 2004, provide a whole labyrinth of explored nooks, crannies, words occupying positions of life and death, family, philosophical wrestlings, and also extraordinary joy, I would say, in conquest of antithetical circumstance. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and more than 800 other Bookworm broadcasts can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.